Roger Ferguson, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
We're here on the roof of your building on a beautiful sunny day in the fall in New York. Tell us a little bit about what we're looking at here, some of the famous buildings.
Okay. We're looking at a number of the famous buildings. Right over your shoulder, Tess, is the skyscraper they built over top of the New York City Post Office. And then right behind that is a building that's now called the MetLife Building.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be the Pan Am Building, 200 Park Avenue, a spectacular building. We can also see from here J.P. Morgan Chase, their Midtown office. And then we have up that way, that Citibank building right there.
And I believe way over my right shoulder we have the Empire State Building.
And there is exactly right, the antenna from the Empire State Building right down there.
Well, you've painted a picture for us of our surroundings here. I wonder if you would paint a picture for us of the retirement outlook today. Are we saving enough?
The answer is the retirement outlook for many people is uncertain. To answer your direct question, most Americans probably are not saving enough. More importantly, though, this crisis has shown the vulnerabilities of the retirement system. We have seen 401ks collapse. It's a very sad and painful joke that 401ks have gone to 201ks.
Right.
Maybe they've come back to 301ks. Not very funny for the people who've lived through that. And then the other leg of the retirement stool, which is Social Security, that's also under a lot of stress. And so we have a number of challenges in the retirement world right now, not just that we're not saving enough, but that almost every element of the retirement system is under stress or has come under question.
You made a speech at the National Press Club a number of months ago in which you said, we are at a pivotal moment in retirement security in this country. How do we make that pivot? I mean, we know the problems the recession and the financial crisis have brought. Now what do we do?
I think in order to make that pivot, Kai, we need to really have a plan. We need to adopt what I describe as a retirement system for the 21st century and be quite clear about what we're doing. And my proposal calls for three or four key elements. First, obviously, we have to have more people in positions where they can save, which is to say get people started savings earlier, get them into retirement systems automatically, so automatic enrollment. Secondly, we do have to tell them how much they need to save. Right? And retirement economists tell us that at this stage, if you want to replace 70 to 80% of your pre-retirement income, you probably need to be saving somewhere around 10 to 14%. When I say you, what I mean is a combination of the individual and the individual's employer. So it's a joint responsibility. The third element of a really good retirement system for the 21st century is an appropriate range of investment options. 15 to 20 investment options is what most professionals tell us is called for. If you have more than that, the behavioral economists tell us that people are stymied with too much choice, too few, and obviously too few. The fourth element of the system that I talk about is a guaranteed income for life. And this is an element that people often overlook because many people think, well, the goal is to save and build up as large a nest egg as possible. Absolutely true, that's important. But then you have to think about how that comes back to you as income during your lifetime in retirement. And then the final thing is that these costs must be kept under control for this entire system. All the data indicate that expenses in your retirement system are an important determinant of the total outcome. So that's the five elements. And to make that pivot, I think we first have to start to be very explicit about what is called for.
Is there something about people in this country that, we all have expenses and many people have lost their jobs and this has been an incredibly difficult time, but we have been non-savers in this country for a long time.
No, you make a very good point, right? We are in the midst of a very slow recovery from a very deep recession, there's no question. But even in the best of times, I think people did not save enough. And we saw that in all the national statistics where at points we had what was measured to be actually a negative savings rate. That was because people were looking at a range of different assets that seemed to go up in value year over year over year almost without fail, and I think relying too much on things such as the equity they built up in their homes. Or, frankly, we've had 20-plus years of relatively good stock market performance, and I think people got a little complacent about that as well. But finally, most as important, there was no one who was really educating individuals on what they needed to do.
For the people who did save, though, you know, one of the common themes running through your plan is that we are all very much now responsible for figuring out our own numbers. The demise of the pension has really meant that it's up to us to try to figure out what to do with the money that we do set aside for retirement. And I wonder if we could get your thoughts on whether we are able to handle that responsibly. Because you look at what happened in the economic crisis, and, you know, people of retirement age were too much in stocks. There were people bailed out at the bottom, which is the opposite of what you're supposed to do. We haven't really learned any lessons yet.
Well, Tess, you put your finger on a very important point. One of the other things that is an important part of the system is to get good advice, objective advice, from, you know, a trusted expert. Because handling one's retirement is, as you point out, relatively complex. There's also just the natural human nature of people wanting to pile in when things look good and then bailing out, running for the exits as soon as things look bad. So there's really a need for good objective advice. In my shop, we also offer non-commissioned advice. We also, though, have to make sure that people are well-educated. So it's a combination of learning a bit more, increasing the level of financial literacy in the country, while also providing as much objective and non-commissioned advice as we possibly can find.
I think if you ask most people, they would say that they don't really pay a lot of attention to their retirement accounts. They may check them once a year, they may not. How often should we be doing that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by check them, right? So I do not encourage people to try to figure out their net worth every week. As the stock market goes up and down, there's much too much volatility. Certainly once a year, you want to check and see where you are. You probably want to do some reallocation depending on how things have unfolded during the course of the year. And importantly, you have to really have a longer-term plan and check year over year to see where you are against that much longer-term outlook. So one has to be careful about being complacent. But on the other hand, I don't think it's wise for people to, you know, churn and burn and watch everything very, very closely on a week-to-week basis. That's more than I think many people can do.
So who handles your retirement?
All of my retirement money is managed by my company at TI Cref, and I've got four very good advisors, actually. I'm not sure everyone needs that.
What do you say, though, to people who are now stuck in a place where, because of circumstances and conditions in the economy, they don't have that retirement, and they are forced now to rely on Social Security and whatever else is out there?
Right. Look, you raise a very serious issue, Kai, because there are a large number of Americans, far too many Americans, who are unemployed. They started with too small a nest egg. One has to be very empathetic, and to be honest with you, there's not an easy answer. But there's an important answer, which is to recognize that most people are going to live in retirement 20 to 30 years. And so wherever you are, whatever one can do to start getting out of that hole is going to be very important. But recognize, as you say, that there are a number of people for whom the current time is not the best time. But the truth is there's never such thing as the best time to start planning for retirement. So whatever one can do, one should do. But you also are correct that there will be a number of people who are going to be heavily reliant on Social Security. Now, the other thing that we've seen is Americans are clearly changing some of their plans. There was a recent Gallup poll, I believe, that showed that about a third of Americans who are not yet 65 plan to work past the age of 65. Back in 1995, I think that same number was around 12% of Americans expected to work past the age of 65. And so it's quite clear that people are adjusting their expectations a bit and recognizing that they are perhaps going to have to work longer because of the crisis that we've just gone through.
You have two kids, right?
I have two kids.
Is Social Security going to be around when they're of need?
The answer to when that Social Security is going to be around depends very much on what policymakers do over the next several years. Because, as you well know, the trustees have already pointed out that in the not-too-distant future, Social Security, the trust fund, is going to start to be depleted. In fact, I think this year is the first year
where cash outlays exceeded income.
And so the answer to your question, when that is going to be around, depends very much on what folks of your generation and my generation do over the next 2 to 3 years to turn to Social Security.
Does it have to be around?
I think some form of Social Security does have to be around, right? Because we're talking about a very large and diverse country. And there are a number of people for whom Social Security is their only retirement system. And for many people, Social Security is an important component of their retirement system. And so I think it behooves us to, policymakers and others, to turn their attention to shoring up the Social Security system.
One of the questions that we're getting a lot these days is, what should I be doing about the stock market? People are very skittish about Wall Street. There's a lot of trust issues out there, from Madoff to, you know, the flash crash of a few months ago. We have young investors writing in saying, you know what, I'm not gonna go there, which of course means that they're probably gonna have to save more money. Older investors don't want to go there because they've already lost as much as they can possibly lose. What's your advice in terms of trying to figure out how much to be in that risky pool?
I think the reality is that everybody has to be in that risky pool to some extent. The stock market over time has had a better return than fixed income. I emphasize over time because there are, you know, there's quite a bit of volatility in that market for sure. But I think people are going to be worse off if they don't have a portion of their incomes or their assets invest in the stock market than if they do. The challenge for them is to figure out how much risk they can afford to take, given the size of their portfolio, given their other sources of income. But I would absolutely advise everyone to continue to have some exposure in the stock market. The amount of exposure depends very much on one's risk appetite. This is an important component of diversification, and without it, you're losing an entire asset class.
But determining your risk appetite is really difficult, especially after the last 2 years.
It's just a scary proposition.
Absolutely, it's absolutely a scary proposition. One won't deny that. But the question of should I avoid it altogether or should I confront it directly, the answer, I think, is you have to confront it directly, because otherwise you leave yourself without one of the major sources of upside potential in the investment world. But recognize that you need broad diversification. One should not think of a single investment class or stock class, you know, as the right thing. So growth versus value investing, et cetera, that range of discussions one really has to have. But to say I'm never going to be exposed to the stock market again, I think that is an imprudent form of being conservative.
I wanted to ask about this company's role as an institutional investor. It holds $400-something billion in trust for other people's investments. You wield incredible amounts of power in the shareholder rights community. You guys just have a lot of pull. Why has that movement of getting shareholders more voice and more power in the decisions of corporations not been successful?
I think it hasn't been fully successful. I would adjust your question. It hasn't been fully successful because not all shareholders, not all institutional investors take exactly the same perspective that we do. I think it has been successful to some degree when you get institutional investors such as ourselves taking a look at some very important issues and engaging with management. So the challenge, I think, is to get more institutional investors deciding to take what I think of as a responsible role as shareholders and engage directly and with management and with boards around a number of key issues.
So what are those key issues? What are the big issues in shareholder rights?
Well, there have been a number of them, some that have emerged relatively recently, others that are longstanding. In our company, I know that our participants have had a longstanding interest in things such as environment, questions of how labor is being treated both domestically and internationally. More recently, obviously, questions of risk and risk management have become very important for shareholders as they think about financial services firms in particular. So there is clearly a range of them.
How do the mechanics work here? Do you meet with fund managers and you guys talk about investment objectives and things like shareholder rights? I mean, are you that detailed?
Well, we have here an entire staff of people dealing with corporate governance and socially responsible investing. They go and meet directly with management of the companies in which we invest. We call it engagement. We try to be very responsible, so we do not wave a red flag around it. Rather, we take a more quiet, but we think equally impactful approach.
But what's your engagement with fund managers here?
Well, obviously, I do a number of things with our own internal fund managers. We generally set their parameters of how much risk they're supposed to take. We have them each identified with a particular type of investment. So some of them are more value-oriented, some of them are international, some to emerging markets. And our job here is to say for each one of those, this is the risk appetite that we as a company have, and we evaluate them on how well they do on a risk-adjusted return, something that we call and is known in the industry as the information ratio. So that is really the way we approach our fund managers.
I wonder if you'd be willing to answer a couple of questions directly from our listeners. We solicited, told them that we were going to be talking to you. Nathan Bishop of Albuquerque, New Mexico, wrote in and said, it seems to me that many people get stars in their eyes about double-digit returns and early retirement. You know, I'm out of here at 58, 59. How does your company talk people out of taking inappropriate risks and maybe guide them to a more achievable goal?
Right. The first thing that we do is we have a very serious conversation with them about their own risk appetite, and we try to broaden that conversation so that they understand both the ups and the downs. Secondly, we look at their entire portfolio, and so that we understand the assets they have with us and assets they may have other places. And then we do something very important, which is we do a modeling of the likely retirement outcome with various different scenarios. So they can then understand the stars in their eyes may not come to reality. What happens if you don't get those double-digit returns, which frankly is more likely reality. And out of that, I think they get brought back to earth, if you will, about reality. But it really is an ongoing discussion of education, guidance, and advice.
And from our Facebook page, Tom Coates wrote in and wanted to know, how do you know how much you will need to retire? He is worried about not only undersaving, but oversaving. And you can go with every calculator in the book and still not know how long you're going to live, for example, you know?
No,
which is
really?
A question.
Come on,
get out. They ask you that question in the calculators, you know?
A couple of things. One is most people should assume that they're going to probably live 20 to 30 years in retirement, which is not very concrete, obviously, because it varies from person to person. As a society, we have seen that we are living longer, and so I think people may, if they aren't careful, underestimate their life expectancy. You're absolutely right. At the end of the day, the calculators can give you a range of answers. That's why we also say to people, well, you should think about replacing 70 to 80% of your pre-retirement income, because that really, I think, targets people in on a number. And then the other thing that we've seen is, and a McKinsey study has shown this, sadly, very few people seem to be over-saving for retirement. The McKinsey study that I most recently saw showed that the average American may be short of retirement savings by something like $250,000. And so while there may be a small handful who are over-saving, it looks as though the vast majority probably aren't saving enough. But again, it goes back to getting some good advice. But recognize that you know, there are the probabilities that you'll live perhaps longer than many people expect in retirement.
There are so many demands on our savings time, though, right? There are so many things we have to save for. Somebody told me once that what you ought to do is think about it like you think about it in an airplane when you're traveling with a kid and the stewardess comes by and says, with the oxygen mask, drop down, take care of yourself first and then take care of the kid, right? So so basically, you've got college accounts and you've got retirement and you've got all sorts of other things. Prioritize for me how people ought to start thinking about that stuff.
Well, look, two or three things. First, recognize that they're not necessarily in conflict. There are, as you say, priorities. I think one always has to put a little something aside for retirement, even as you're paying for your mortgage, paying for your children's education. And you recognize that as those other demands on your savings go away, you should increase what you're saving for retirement. One way to handle that is through what's called auto escalation, so that as your incomes go up, the percentage that you save for retirement goes up gradually as well. So that's one way to think about it, is to put a little bit of it on an automatic pilot so that you aren't always forced to make these trade-offs. But the reality is absolutely right. You need to set some priorities, first things first, and for most of us, pay for that mortgage, pay for that kid's education, but think about yourself as well. All along by putting away something for retirement, and then as you are freed from other obligations, increase the rate at which you save for your own retirement.
I know that the company has been holding a contest to get folks to give you some ideas to get the national savings rate to 10%, I believe it
is.
Can you share some of the answers with us that you have so far?
Thanks for asking that. It's called Raise the Rate. You can find it on the TI Craft website. And indeed, we've had a range of ideas. Most of them have been what I describe as micro. So frankly, people are saying, I'm going to give up a cup of coffee every week. I won't mention the brand name, but you can all guess which one.
They're everywhere and they cost $4, and yeah.
Exactly right. So imagine if you, you know, set aside a little bit of that. A number of people who have linked their savings with their concerns about the environment and decide that they are going to take public transportation. So that's the kind of thing we've seen, a number of ideas that are really very much focused in on what I as an individual can do with my own lifestyle to save an extra $5 to $10 a week that then mounts up over time.
So let's ask the macro question then. You are a trained economist. How do we increase the national savings rate? And you don't get the prize if you win your company's contest.
No, I do not get the prize.
Right.
Increase the national savings rate, I think, has a much bigger challenge, if you will. But not to take away from these small ideas. So if everyone did some of that, that would certainly help. We also clearly are going to have to change our mindset. It's back to the point you raised earlier on, Kai. We are a society of consumers. So part of this is going to be a big shift in national mindset towards putting aside more money for savings and just thinking about it more broadly in those terms. But there is no magic bullet around the national savings rate. This is one of the things that has vexed economists for some time in the past and probably will continue to do so going forward.
Well, and then, of course, you do have the people who say, look, you tell me I'm supposed to save, but then you tell me if I don't spend my money that the economy is going to get worse and worse and worse.
Right. Look, we're talking here at a very unusual time, which is the turnaround from this very, very deep recession. And so both things are true. In order to keep the economy going, people are going to have to continue to spend appropriately. What we've been talking about, though, is a longer-term perspective, right? So as the economy heals, we are going to have to, I think, have an American economy that is more balanced away from consumption and more towards savings and investment. So one has to be able to keep both ideas in mind simultaneously.
On that point, though, you are a member of the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. I'm wondering if you'd share with us how those meetings are going. Because it's you know, tricky.
Well, there's no question that it's tricky. We give the president a range of different advice. For example, one of the groups that I was on just came out with a report on simplifying, streamlining the tax system. And that seems to have certainly piqued everyone's interest or many people's interest. We had some early discussion around an infrastructure bank, and that played into one of the president's recent initiatives. And so I'd say the conversations, though it is a tricky time, we are coming up with one or two ideas that seem to be of interest. The sad truth is there is no easy fix for the current relatively gradual turnaround. There's not going to be a silver bullet that's suddenly going to get us back to maximum employment in the U.S. for some time to come.
How concerned are you, though, as a guy whose job is taking care of the retirement of a huge chunk of the American people, and a guy who advises the President of the United States on the economic recovery, how concerned are you about the deficit? Because it's getting bigger. People are talking about it a lot.
Again, it goes to the issue of priorities. I think over the long term, a deficit of this scale is clearly not sustainable. But recognize that, as many economists would suggest, in order to get out of a recession, you do need some element of deficit spending, which is what we've had. So I think now the challenge, and it's a balancing act, is to figure out how to gradually talk about and start gradually to reduce the deficit, but not do it so quickly that we throw this nascent recovery off. And so I think most economists are, as a long-term matter, concerned about the deficit for this year and probably for next year. Probably more focus should be on getting the economy on a much more stable footing as opposed to trying to rein in this deficit, which we all know is not sustainable over the long term.
I started out by asking you to paint a picture of retirement now. I wonder if you could now step back and give us a picture of retirement in the future. Is it as good as it has been? Is it better? Is it more difficult?
Well, I think certainly getting is a bit more difficult for the reason that you pointed out. Right, our parents and grandparents, many of them, most of them worked in companies that had what was called a defined benefit plan. And so they knew how their retirement was going to unfold because that big company that had given them a job for 25 or 30 years was going to take care of them for another 20 years in retirement. As you pointed out, we've reached a stage now where individuals have a much larger responsibility for their retirement. So in that sense, it's a little more challenging. I do believe it can be as good, though. And particularly, I believe it can be as good if people think about not just saving and asset accumulation, but also the earlier point I made, thinking about how they're going to get a payout, how they're going to have guaranteed income for life, save enough to convert to guaranteed income for life, and you end up in exactly the same place. The process is slightly more complicated, but I do believe that over time we can create a society in which retirements are as good as they have been historically. But I emphasize over time, not a quick turnaround.
It seems almost a fantasy, this idea you have of guaranteed income for life. I mean, that just...
No, it's not a fantasy at all. It is today it's known as an annuity. Our company provides annuities. More than a third of our participants take advantage of that option, and I hope more will going forward. So these things do exist already. The challenge around annuities is that we've got to make them simpler, and cheaper, easier to explain, but they do exist. And they've got to be backed up by companies such as my own, which are safe and secure and have a deep capital base.
Meanwhile, people are still losing their jobs. They can't make the house payment. They can't make the car payment. They can't pay for the kids' college. And yet, we as a society are expected to contribute to, whether it's an annuity or a 403B, whatever it is, the oomph just isn't there, right? I mean, you can only save so much money.
The oomph is not there today, right? I will be the first to admit that the challenges that you talk about are very real. But I believe in order to get this moving forward, we have to at least have a goal and objective of what we're trying to do. And so I'm not on your radio show telling people that whatever you do today, you must immediately ramp up your savings. I know that's not realistic for many people. You know, if you don't have an income, the thought of saving from your income is not a realistic thought. As the economy turns, and it will continue to get better, I firmly believe, we need to have a view of where it is that we're headed. Because what happened over the recent past is the defined benefit plans went away. The 401k, which was never intended to be the main retirement system for most Americans, became the main retirement system for many Americans. We discovered that wasn't wisely invested. And so I think what America needs now is step by step to get out of the recession, as it has been doing, continue on the path of recovery. As people get back on their feet, then they need to have some guidance about the kind of plan that they need overall, both as individuals and society. And so we're in the beginning moments of what I think will be a pretty long national discussion about what to do going forward to deal with both the retirement issue, the savings issue, aging populations, et cetera. So I'd be quite surprised if many of your listeners, having listened to this, go on Monday and change their behaviors.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. But I would expect that over the next several years we can get this dialogue going and people will have a better sense of how to protect themselves for the future.
What are you hoping your retirement looks like?
I'm hoping my retirement looks very much, frankly, like, in some sense, like my work, which is to say I am one of those people who has been fortunate. I have a white-collar kind of job, and I would expect during my retirement that I will not be as fully engaged, but I want to continue to be pretty active intellectually and physically around economic topics, retirement topics, financial literacy, and providing ongoing guidance and advice to as many citizens as I can while still calling myself, in quotes, retired.
You spent a number of years, 7 or 8 years, on the board of the Federal Reserve, served with Chairman Greenspan and Chairman Bernanke at the very end there. I'm wondering, though, if you have any thoughts about the early parts of this decade when interest rates were going down and Chairman Greenspan was lowering those interest rates, and if you had it to do over again, would you pull them aside and said, hey, Alan, this whole really low interest rate thing right now, maybe not a good idea?
You know, I think it's important to think back to the information we had at those moments, and particularly in 2001, we had just come off of the bursting of the tech bubble, the 9/11 attacks here in New York, a great deal of uncertainty about the outcome, real concerns about deflation. And so a variety of people were saying, you know, interest rates low is what's important to create the right kind of cushion. You know, the Fed started raising interest rates, signaling that long before it occurred. And the thing that was interesting was even as the Fed was raising short-term interest rates, long-term rates weren't going up.
Okay.
And so it goes back to one of the earlier conversations we were having. I think the big challenge around interest rates during the earlier part of this century, in the early part of this decade, was these global imbalances and low interest rates everywhere, not just at the short end of the yield curve, which is what central banks control, but out at the 10-year range as well. So it goes back to, I think, some of the issues that we've been talking about of global imbalances, the U.S. consuming too much, others savings too much, and excess savings pouring back into the U.S. markets.
Do you subscribe to the belief that maybe rates were too low for too long?
That's going to be an issue that's going to be debated for some time. And, you know, as you probably saw, Ben Bernanke 2 years ago gave a long speech taking just the opposite perspective on that one. There will be dissertations written about it, lots of things written about it. I think ultimately there are a number of forces that are at work. So global interest rates that were relatively low, imbalances, financial innovation, frankly, to some degree, a lack of financial literacy. So the kind of recession that we're dealing with, I think, had many, many causes. Global interest rates were certainly one of them.
As we sit here on this terrace, surrounded by the buildings of J.P. Morgan and Citibank and the rest of the financial sector, where's the culpability for what happened to people's retirement accounts? Is it in these buildings around us? Is it with us?
Look, I subscribe to a general view that nothing this complex happens because there is one guilty party, right? You opened up by pointing out the fact that the U.S. is not a savings economy. That's one of the things that happened. Secondly, there are some big swings in the way people work that led us to move away from defined benefit plans to 401k plans. There was, I think, a lack of good advice and information and education for many people. So anything this complex, Kai, I think has many, many points of failure, some in the financial services sector, some with individuals, and frankly, some that were just fundamental big shifts in the way America works and does business that are no one's fault in particular. So we've come to this place, I think, through a combination of forces.
So this is a little bit off topic, but have you ever called the marketing guys in and said, listen, this whole TIA CREF thing, you're killing us in branding and marketing? I mean, come on.
This company has been around for 92 years. We're very proud of the market that we serve, which includes everyone in the not-for-profit sector. We are very importantly thinking about how to make sure people understand what that mouthful of letters stands for. And what it stands for is safety and security, working with people to get them safely to and through retirement.
So
that's our brand.
Yeah, maybe you're thinking about it?
Maybe I'm thinking about reinforcing the brand image for sure. There's no question of that.
Roger Ferguson, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.